Thank you, Paul. And the questions are already coming in, so we'll save all the questions until after all three panelists finish up. So next is Virginia Arbery. She holds a doctorate in political philosophy from the University of Dallas, a Richard Weaver Fellow and a Fellow of the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. She has taught at the University of Dallas, Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, St. Anselm College, Austin College, the University of Texas at Dallas, and at Assumption College. She has served as Director of Admissions at University of Dallas and Dean of Admissions at the University of St. Thomas in Houston and at Thomas More College. While on the faculty of the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, she co-authored and directed a nationally recognized grant from the U.S. Department of Education to educate high school teachers in American founding documents. She has written and lectured extensively on the American founding and on constitutional and cultural issues. Professor Arbery has also published on Greek comedy and tragedy, on Southern literature, on Augustine, on Rousseau, on women's studies, and on American education. She's a former member of the board of the Philadelphia Society, a co-recipient with her husband, Glenn, of the Russell Kirk Prize for a Lifetime Achievement in Humanities. Professor Arbery is an associate professor in humanities at Wyoming Catholic College. So she's left Texas, now she's in Wyoming, right?
Yeah.
So here she is, Virginia Arbery.
All right. Reflecting on the devastating social effects of the French Revolution, Tocqueville identified the political heresy that those who hold a vision for society that includes the license to overturn its moral code in order to actualize the vision are dangerous. He wrote in Democracy in America, "Up to now, no one has been encountered in the United States who dared to advance the maxim that everything is permitted in the interest of society." "An impious maxim," he continues, "one that seems to have been invented in a century of freedom to legitimate all the tyrants to come." In the Frankfurt School, only one considered himself an activist. He had actually shot a rifle in the 1919 German Socialist Revolution that failed and ended only with the Weimar Republic. He shared his colleagues' Marxist assumptions, but he dared to advance the maxim that everything is permitted in the interest of society. Later, his reading of Freud would combine with his Marxist roots, leading him to see vistas beyond the superstructure and beyond Oedipal's sexual repression and the psyche. In line with the Frankfurt School's direction, Marcuse explored how culture and underlying secondary institutions of society might be overturned to fashion a new man, as Paul just suggests, a non-acquisitive man, untainted by the work ethic, but in harmony with Mother Nature. From an uprooted culture which had repressed and alienated man, a liberated man with a new consciousness would emerge after the violence, where everything was permitted. This new consciousness would take time to emerge, and in this country, Herbert Marcuse became its major spokesman in his long march through the American Academy. Though he disclaimed the title accorded him in his 70s, the father of the New Left, Marcuse had earned it. A lecturer at Columbia, he strongly influenced future professors in the School of Education and countless others whom he later taught at Brandeis and University of California, San Diego. He called upon his university students here and abroad to make the great refusal, a term he took from Breton, pronouncing that the solidarity of the human species rather than competition, eros rather than logos, peace rather than property, would result in liberation. As utopian as his vision is, one has to admit that a careful reading of his work underscores that he is a serious thinker. Marcuse had studied with Heidegger at Freiburg. He thought deeply and often cogently about the dehumanizing effect of the technological society. He thought deeply about Marx as well, and he melded Marx, though Heidegger had never read him, with notions of the capitalist man being an instrument of production. And he melded that with Heidegger's view that technology had transformed nature into standing reserve. The aesthetically minded Marcuse hoped for a fuller human reality where play and unity with nature could be restored. Given his Rousseauan anthropology, he deplored the way in which conventional norms distanced man from his natural goodness and his untutored instincts. A mechanistic world driven by technology that intruded into men's very psyches made all beings, whether producer or laborer, instruments of some other will than their own. Such a life robbed men of their natural inclination for beauty and gratification. He, in fact, Marcuse, deplored the gray-on-gray world of socialist countries, of drab Soviet proletarian pretensions, along with the functionality of the administrative state, critiquing them both as extra-political and numbing upon the society. He rejected the charge, though, that his hope for a full life in union with nature and one's fellow man was utopian. But these more palatable writings, at times he sounds like a Southern agrarian reading him, were not what ignited multiple generations who would be committed to the maxim that everything is permitted in the interest of society. It was his radical and violent social teaching that would inspire his students to overturn cultural institutions from the family to the university, from the courtroom to the churches. Out of anarchy, a peaceful order would triumph. Just as in the late Roman Republic in the first century before Christ, Epicureanism advised the rejection of heroic virtues and redefined the nature of things, Marcuse's thought unseated the ruler at every level of hierarchy, beginning with pater familias. In his 1966 preface to one of his major works, Eros and Civilization, Marcuse called the young to, quote, revolt against false teachers, false fathers, and heroes, and join, quote, solidarity with the wretched of the earth. The body would take the place of the political machine. In the new bohemian conjunction of the erotic and the political, the popular slogan, make love, not war, would be victorious, and everything would be permitted, that is to say, eroticized. Marcuse decried the superstructure and monogamous patriarchal sexual relations, saying that they were unnatural, imposed upon man's instinctual appetites. Civilization had imposed a second nature upon human beings, rejecting the Platonic order of the soul, where reason should suppress through the help of spiritedness the appetites. Marcuse saw rule itself as repression. The real motives of any political rule were domination and personal aggrandizement. He agreed with Freud in his Civilization and Its Discontents in arguing that history is a story of such unnatural repression of instinctual appetites. But while Freud thought it was necessary for civilization, Marcuse went the next step. Political hegemony of any kind, in his view, dominated the ego and the id with the superego, and bourgeois consumerism stirred up niggling desires for comfort and comprehensively suppressed instinctual gratification. Even the laborer had observed the bourgeois consumerism. When he turned his attention to the failed Marxist revolution of the proletarian, and asked why the oppressed class then never overturned the superstructure, he answered, because the worker had undergone a, quote, socially engineered arrest of consciousness, unquote. In this stunted human condition, what was to be done? Marcuse found models for the youth of America in the young radicals of Cuba and the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The earlier Spanish Civil War provided the prototype, the union of young intellectuals and workers. He glamorized how their radical vision gave them license to overturn the moral code. He called upon young militants to take back the life of human beings, quote, which had become the plaything in the hands of politicians, managers, and generals. Make it worth living again. Marcuse's success played to the moment. His rallying cry capitalized on the fortuitous convergence of three movements that roused the spiritedness of my generation: the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, and the anti-war movement. Especially the first, the civil rights movement, as a node of rebellion, as he observed, the black population appears as the most natural force of the rebellion. To exploit this convergence required the re-education of the young. And how would re-education take place? Consciousness had to be changed, at which point the young would feel a biological need, these are his terms, for a new order to reflect the change. Marcuse writes of the New Left, quote, for them, this is not a question of choice. The protest and refusal are parts of their metabolism, unquote. Resurrecting a dormant libido was the key. A polymorphous sexuality which transformed, quote, the libido from sexuality constrained under genital supremacy to eroticization of the entire personality. You can unpack that later over lunch. In Eros and Civilization, Marcuse's proposed solution to the alienation accompanying labor is a renewed gratification, the pleasure principle, over Freud's reality principle of civilization. Political re-education or conscious changing began with the reversal of the meaning of words. And as Paul suggests, these are old tricks. You can read about the Corcyran Revolution in Thucydides and see that the changing of the meaning of words is an exact indicator of the loss of the meaning of reality. Classrooms were free to use the F word. The understanding of what was obscene would no longer be sexual excesses, but instead the medals on a decorated general, a corporate executive's boardroom, the robes on a priest. Not just the police, but the patriot, the hero, and the believer were all pigs. Violence against them was not an offense. He asks, can one meaningfully call it an offense when demonstrators disrupt the business of the university, the draft board, the supermarket, the flow of traffic, to protest against the far more efficient disruption of the business of life, of untold numbers of human beings, by the armed forces of law and order? Here too, he continues, the brute reality requires a redefinition of terms. Marcuse is clear, one cannot reform democratic society. The goal is creating a free society for the first time. Thus, he writes, in some sectors of opposition, the radical protest tends to become antinomian, anarchistic, and even non-political. So instead of Burkean platoons of society, which build up the fabric, Marcuse explicitly called for the new small groups of anarchy, flexible, autonomous, and mobile. In my sophomore year at a sleepy Hoosier college with a Campus Crusade for Christ chapter, Air Force ROTC, and YAF, which I started, my intellectual history professor assigned us a new book by Marcuse, 1969, Essay on Liberation. The professor thought we should sympathize with the students in France who had rioted against Charles de Gaulle in May 1966, chanting Marx, Mao, Marcuse. Essay on Liberation terrified me with sentences like these: the anarchic element is an essential factor in the struggle against domination. And the Cuban Revolution and the Viet Cong have demonstrated that it can be done. And what was it? The internal weakening of the superpower. The radicalism of the New Left would, quote, disintegrate the capitalist system. The internal weakening would be achieved through undermining the moral fiber of the nation in the labor force, through disobedience to rules and regulations, wildcat strikes, boycotts, sabotage, etc. Reassigning the term totalitarian to the technocratic political administration, Marcuse argued that labor by itself could not achieve the new order. The young and their enlightened college professors, his former students, as Christopher Rufo and others have pointed out, would reunite with the disaffected blacks and with the wretched to become what Lenin would call the new vanguard. Curricula would change to reflect studies of the great nonconformist movements in civilization and to critical studies of contemporary societies. Both done. His rhetoric was immensely attractive to my generation, such as his protege, Angela Davis. It appealed to the spirited part of the soul. In his letter to Angela Davis while she was in prison, Marcuse exonerated her complicity in murder. The professor called his student, quote, the great symbol of the new proletariat, the synthetic union of the white intelligentsia and the black ghetto. Davis had incarnated his theories. Black power radicals would accelerate racial tensions in America and lay the fertile ground for an uprising. Some of us remember that she bought guns for a courtroom takeover during a jury trial of one of her friends. The judge was killed, the assistant attorney general paralyzed as she planned the getaway car for the offenders. The all-white jury, stupefied into demonstrating their lack of prejudice, found her not guilty. What she and Bernadette Dorn, a future professor at Northwestern, a Weathers member, and others demonstrated was that Marcuse's platoons of random anarchists could successfully carry out illegal operations without repercussions. Untethered to a hypocritical insistence on law and order, he aroused his students to bring about a new kind of man, freed into a new kind of reason, because everything was permitted to do so. From utopian hopes, his teaching had morphed into total revolution. Religion and morality, the pillars of republican rule, must be toppled. Tocqueville had written in Democracy in America that religion was the first of political institutions, and it was the first to go. He observed that religion prevents them from conceiving everything and forbids them to do everything. In this generation, of course, I hate to say it because I listen to it, rock music fueled the new biological need. Happiness would follow a non-generative sexual activity. Violence and eros were powerfully paired. A bit naive, Marcuse was angered when students refused to attend his classes, shouting chants rather than listening. By liberating instincts and changing language, the father of the revolution had made learning and contemplation impossible. And why should he have been surprised? He had taught them to replace the logos with eros. When Marcuse wrote his repressive tolerance in his 65 essay, he wrote a blueprint for the ubiquitous censorship of our day, saying, liberating tolerance would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements only from the left. The small and powerless minorities which struggle against the false consciousness and its beneficiaries must be helped. Their continued existence is more important than the preservation of abused rights and liberties which grant constitutional powers to those who oppress the minorities. The exercise of civil rights by those who don't have them presupposes the withdrawal of civil rights from those who prevent their exercise. So we have seen the arc of Marcuse's teaching in the summer of 2020. And predictably, just as Marcuse saw the 60s offering a real chance to begin this conjunction of the erotic and the political, Angela Davis, euphoric in her 80s, saw in the Floyd riots a jumpstart for the new social order. The violence was erotic. But the enemy of gratification and the limits of it are death and satiety. Death proposes an ineradicable limit to the pleasure principle. Partially getting around this problem, Marcuse taught in Eros and Civilization that euthanasia would eliminate painful endings to one's death. To my mind, Marcuse's teaching eradicates the image of Pius Aeneas supporting his old father on his shoulders, carrying the household gods, and leading his young son out of the burning Troy. He substitutes the impious one. The hero would throw his father off his back, refuse to carry the household gods, and leave the child to his own Freudian gratifications. Moreover, Aeneas would never leave Dido to obey the gods and found Rome. Bereft of the hero, Western civilization is obsolete. Marcuse had dared to advance the maxim that everything is permitted in the interest of society. Duty must give way to pleasures, play, art, and a leisure without worship. But the most stunning claim that Marcuse makes, and he's a real lover of the beautiful, he's a man of old world tastes, right. The real stunning claim is that you can still have the supernatural, spiritual sense of things without a transcendent hierarchy. Having removed the chief enemies of erotic fulfillment, that is, belief in rewards and punishments in the afterlife, man would be free, in his view, to be truly philosophic. But what if, having dethroned the transcendent, the great refusal leads to yet another gray-on-gray world, described by Paul, of commissaries, of bureaucracy, whether under socialism or liberal democracy? And to color that gray red with blood would be a high cost for no joy, for illusory pleasures purchased at the expense of the good.